So every year, over 400 people die from asthma in Australia. And when you think that asthma is a treatable disease, we don't think that it's acceptable.
That's Professor Peter Gibson, Senior Respiratory Specialist at the John Hunter Hospital and academic at the University of Newcastle.
In the 90s, we had a really severe problem, and through important efforts, death rates dropped until about 2005. But since then, there's been no further improvement. We've been recommending the same approaches to treatment all that time, but haven't seen any further improvement.
Australia and New Zealand have relatively high rates of asthma, with a population rate of about 1 in 9. The majority of these patients manage the disease effectively with a combination of reliever and controller medications. Short-acting beta-adrenergic agonists like salbutamol are used as bronchodilators during wheezing episodes. And inhaled corticosteroids like budesonide reduce the inflammation that leads to airway constriction. For years, the management model has been empirical. The more serious the disease, the more the dose of corticosteroids is increased. But this therapy doesn't work for everyone.
Now, a small group of people won't respond to that intervention either. So a message for a physician would be any asthmatic that gets admitted to hospital, you should ask yourself the question, why did this happen? What can be done to prevent it? And could this person have a background of severe refractory asthma? And that's what's driving the hospitalisation.
Welcome to Pomegranate Health, a podcast for physicians of the RACP. I'm Mick Capazzini. Around 10% of asthma patients respond poorly or not at all to maximal therapy. They exhibit a chronic narrowing of the airways that can present like COPD, as measured by forced exhalation volume over 1 second. And they have frequent exacerbations that can require hospitalisation. This small population represents a high disease burden. Professor Gibson published a clinical perspectives review on severe asthma management in June's Internal Medicine Journal, with co-author Vanessa McDonald.
I'm Vanessa McDonald, Professor of Nursing at the School of Nursing and Midwifery at the University of Newcastle and a clinical nurse consultant at John Hunter.
We'll discuss some of Professor McDonald's work on the social contributors to disease later. But first, we'll describe the three or more pathological pathways underlying asthma. An inflammatory increase in the airway eosinophil population is associated with the allergic and the eosinophilic endotypes of severe asthma.
One thing probably worth noting is endotypes not used apart from severe asthma, and it was a word that was coined by a professor of pharmacology in Melbourne, Gary Anderson, so we should own the little Australian invention. And what it refers to is a pathophysiological pathway that's linked to a clinical phenotype. And when you get those two things linking up, you're on the path to targeted treatment. So we have that for allergic asthma and eosinophilic asthma. There are two mechanisms that could lead to recruitment of eosinophils. So the T helper type 2 mechanism explains how allergen could drive eosinophilia. The mechanism of that is very well understood now. That results in the production of hematopoietic cytokines such as interleukin-5, interleukin-4, interleukin-13, and they promote the high levels of eosinophils. But that phenotype where there's non-allergic late-onset eosinophilic asthma, it's been a puzzle, and it turns out that there's another subtype of lymphocytes found, innate lymphoid cells, and they can produce IL-5 and recruit eosinophils.
I read that blood eosinophils were not a particularly reliable measure. How did you establish what blood count would make a useful threshold for disease?
So what we did was, in a large number of people across several cities around Australia, we collected induced sputum and looked at eosinophil counts and did a full blood count to measure blood eosinophils. And we then tried to work out, okay, what's the blood level that will predict eosinophilic asthma defined as 3% or more in sputum. So what you can say is if a person's in front of you with symptomatic asthma on inhaled steroids and their blood count shows greater than 0.3 times 10 to the 9 per litre eosinophils, then they most likely will have eosinophilic asthma. It's also worth thinking that the upper limit of normal given by most pathology labs is 0.4 or 0.5. So we're often talking about levels that are just touching the upper limit of normal or just above. But it may be that the upper limit of normal isn't exactly accurate. Also, if you've got any eosinophils and you're taking steroids, then that indicates some degree of refractory disease, because blood eosinophils melt away with any systemic steroid. Another way to measure it is exhaled nitric oxide. That can also indicate airway eosinophilic inflammation.
Can you explain exactly how corticosteroids affect eosinophil numbers?
Yeah, they do a couple of things. They target T lymphocytes, turn off IL-5, and then they prevent release of eosinophils from the marrow, and then they induce apoptosis in circulating eosinophils.
A review in the European Respiratory Journal from a couple of years ago suggested that the reason inhaled corticosteroids aren't effective in severe asthma is that the extreme inflammation prevents the drugs from getting into the smallest airways, but that oral or intramuscular delivery allows the drug to reach those targets via the bloodstream.
That's not the only possibility. Another possibility is that there's a significant bone marrow component to refractory eosinophilic asthma, and that you're actually targeting that by systemic treatment. If you give systemic steroids, you'll achieve a better result, but at a greater toxicity.
So what are the side effects of systemic corticosteroids to be aware of?
Well, I guess they're associated with multiple side effects, particularly with longer term use. So they'll affect the bone health, lead to hypertension, mood disturbance, disturbed sleep, adrenal insufficiency.
Cataracts. Worsened diabetes.
Diabetes, yeah.
So obesity.
So the adverse effects associated with oral corticosteroids are many, and people are acutely aware of this as well.
Yeah.
So are often averse to taking oral corticosteroids. I mean, the approach in severe asthma is to rationalise the use of oral corticosteroids only to those that need it, and then to use it for exacerbation management in shorter bursts to minimise the side effects.
So everyone that needs maintenance oral steroids is going to get some sort of side effect, and they can be disastrous. Say you've got this aggressive disease that might kill you on the one hand, and on the other hand you've got this very toxic treatment that will give some control but not complete control to the disease. The real breakthrough with focused or targeted therapy has been that we've all of a sudden got an effective treatment that doesn't have the toxicity, and where you can show, at least in the case of the anti-IL-5 treatments, that you can reduce the maintenance dose of oral steroid and even get people off oral steroids. So that's the basis for the great excitement about this approach to treatment in severe asthma, because it's solved an awful problem for patients and clinicians.
Can you tell us how this new monoclonal antibody mepolizumab works? Is that something clinicians would need to know?
Well, if you're going to use this drug, you would want to know about it. So we mentioned earlier that interleukin-5 is the main hematopoietic cytokine that controls the growth, differentiation and production of eosinophils. And monoclonal antibodies have now been developed that specifically block interleukin-5 or block its receptors. So mepolizumab is registered for use in Australia at the moment, but there are several others that are in various stages of development. They're all highly efficacious at reducing blood eosinophil counts, and in the setting of severe refractory eosinophilic asthma, they lead to substantial reductions in asthma attacks.
And am I right that another feature separating eosinophilic asthma from allergic is that it can emerge quite late in life?
So there's a particular phenotype that clinicians should recognise, and that is late onset eosinophilic asthma that often is progressively severe over time and associated with nasal polyps. So they're people who haven't had asthma as a kid, but in their late 40s they'd start to develop asthma, and they can also be sensitive to aspirin and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
There is significant overlap between patients with airway eosinophilia and those that also have allergy. The Th2 cells that recruit eosinophils in allergic asthma also generate interleukins 4 and 13. These in turn activate B cells to produce specific IgE antibodies that can be detected in blood. But IgE is also elevated in a subset of patients without increased eosinophils, and allergy underlies disease in about 70% of asthmatics generally.
So allergy in severe asthma is relevant as a trigger factor. If you can identify and remove a trigger, there will be symptomatic improvement. So in Australia, the most frequent important one for severe asthma is dust mite, but there are others. So domestic animals, cats, importantly, and fungi and cockroaches.
Vanessa, is the public aware of how to protect themselves from such triggers?
Just anecdotally from talking to people in the clinic, generally no. Generally people aren't aware of strategies to go about to reduce their exposure to a lot of those allergens. Or if it's the cat, for example, aren't prepared to reduce their exposure.
Some patients, their occupation will be driving their asthma. And it's there it's important to identify and remove triggers. So in allergic asthma, you get allergen-specific IgE on the surface of mast cells. You get an increase in mast cells in the airway mucosa. So there's normally not that many in the airway epithelium, but the numbers go up. They move into the epithelium when the person's sensitized. And then when you inhale the allergen, you set off the mast cells, release histamine, leukotrienes, and you get massive airway narrowing and severe asthma. So omalizumab or anti-IgE acts to block circulating IgE and eventually reduces tissue-bound IgE, and then you get reduced allergic responses. So at the moment, omalizumab's approved for use in severe refractory allergic asthma. So you've got to tick all of those boxes. You have to identify that the person is actually allergic, and that is done by the serum IgE level and also demonstrating allergen-specific IgE, either by a blood test or by a skin prick test.
In the IMJ paper, you say that a limitation of the monoclonal therapy is its narrow therapeutic window. Will this make dosing a challenge for clinicians?
So what we're referring to there is registered use of the drug is based on a narrow range of serum IgE and body weight, and that determines the recommended dosing. But if someone has a very high IgE level, then they may be outside the dosing table. And there hasn't been randomised trial evidence to advise the efficacy in that situation. But the Australian omalizumab registry collected data on patients who were being treated outside of that dose table at the upper end and showed that they responded just as well to those with lower levels of IgE.
Right, that's interesting, because I don't think that was in the paper.
It hadn't been published at that point, yeah.
Okay, and the treatment is delivered by injection. Does that make it easier or harder to manage patients?
So omalizumab is subcutaneous injection every 2 to 4 weeks. That's a hassle for the patient and the clinic. So there has to be staffing to give the injection and monitor the patient afterwards, and the patient has to rock up to get their dose every 2 to 4 weeks. So it's got quite significant resource implications. The only plus of it, I guess, is that the person does get very closely monitored, and non-adherence is dealt with by the fact that they turn up or they don't, and they get a phone call if they don't. So it addresses those issues, but it's intensive implementation strategy.
The most baffling group of patients are those that present with normal IgE and normal eosinophil counts. And these make up about half of all asthmatics. Peter Gibson explains how there is further heterogeneity even within this non-eosinophilic phenotype, and a lack of targeted treatments on offer.
And they are further subdivided into those that have elevated neutrophil counts, about 60% or more, so that's quite a high neutrophil count. And then a group where both eosinophils and neutrophils are normal. And with our thinking is that that's a macrophage-driven disease, whereas the neutrophil group could be driven by chronic infection or chronic dysfunction of the innate immune system, or both. And interleukin-1 beta is a key cytokine that's driving that condition.
Are patients with this non-eosinophilic asthma the cluster that is most at sea in terms of treatment?
Well, the problems they have are they don't respond well to inhaled steroids. You can treat their airway obstruction with bronchodilators, which is fine, but we don't have anything specifically for their endotype until last week. So we published in The Lancet last week a clinical trial of azithromycin, a macrolide antibiotic, and we showed that it was effective at reducing exacerbations in non-eosinophilic asthma, a 40% reduction.
And some of your research has shown a prevalence of airway microbes in these patients. So is that how you might explain the effectiveness of the macrolide antibiotics?
Certainly, the people with neutrophilic asthma are more likely to have pathogens in their airway and they respond to macrolides. But just as many don't have the pathogens and appear to respond. So what's going on there, we don't know.
And besides this new result involving macrolides, what's the role for long-acting bronchodilators in therapy?
There are a number of options available. There's budesonide with efavirenz, there's fluticasone with salmeterol, there's fluticasone furoate with velanterol. But in severe asthma, long-acting bronchodilators shouldn't be delivered or prescribed without an inhaled corticosteroid. The other thing that has recently kind of come out within the literature is the role of long-acting muscarinic agents in a severe asthma population, one example being tiotropium. So as an additional add-on therapy that tends to lead to improvements in symptoms and bronchodilation. And the leukotriene receptor antagonists, oral medication that can have an effect. It's not an outstanding effect, maybe about 30% of the population with severe asthma that trial the drug get some benefit from using it when you get to the end of the line thinking what can be added to conventional treatment. And I guess...
So that's that guideline paradigm at the moment, if you just keep adding stuff in.
Peter, in terms of diagnostics, you've also been investigating possible proteomic biomarkers and even RNA. Are these a long way off from the lab?
Well, so we've identified the mechanistic pathway of neutrophilic asthma, and that's via innate immune dysfunction, activation of the NLRP3 inflammasome, which then produces IL-1 beta and leads to neutrophil activation and recruitment. And the other thing we've done is identify a messenger RNA gene signature that will distinguish these inflammatory phenotypes. And the value of that is the test could be automated using existing laboratory technologies. For example, molecular diagnostics of sputum samples is now standard for viral and TB, for example. We think it's definitely got a place in severe asthma, and it's going to be more likely implemented than, say, cell counts.
Asthma therapy is not just about phenotyping and cutting-edge therapy. A 2015 article in the MJA suggested that 1 million Australians may have uncontrolled asthma simply due to poor adherence and lifestyle issues, rather than a resistance to treatment. It's important to identify these patients so they don't become subjected to ever-increasing doses of corticosteroids. Vanessa McDonald describes the comorbidities and behavioural factors that must be considered for effective management of the disease.
So we recognise in severe asthma or complex airways diseases that they are heterogeneous diseases. They're complicated by multiple comorbidities. So the approach that we propose is around multidimensional assessment, and this is kind of stepping towards a precision medicine approach. So we kind of summarise it to three different domains: the domain of the airway, comorbidities, and risk factors. In terms of risk factors, there's things like physical inactivity, smoking, obesity, and these are highly prevalent in a severe asthma population. And then there's comorbidities like anxiety and depression, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease that are also common in a severe asthma population.
Can you elaborate on the importance of obesity in this equation?
Yeah, so obesity is a big problem in severe asthma. So in a national study that we published last year, obesity was prevalent in about 45% of the population with severe asthma, and it's a risk factor for more severe disease as well. And there's been some work that suggests that by losing weight, so as little as 5 to 10% of someone's body weight, can actually lead to improved asthma control.
So is obesity a risk factor in itself, or is it simply a consequence of a more sedentary lifestyle?
The answer is yes to both of those. So there are some people who don't get asthma until they become obese. And there is some work in small numbers of people who've had bariatric surgery for morbid obesity and their asthma goes away. So at least in some people, there's a fairly convincing case that morbid obesity is a primary cause. But that's probably not the majority. Most people, it's the severe disease itself, limited physical activity, that contributes to obesity and severe asthma.
So people with severe asthma might need to see a number of different healthcare professionals in order to manage their overall disease. Their care might be fragmented, and therefore the disease kind of is complicated by the financial burdens and the burden of symptoms, and that impacts on their adherence for management. A year or so ago, we held a roundtable discussion with clinicians managing severe asthma around Australia, and the primary care physicians highlighted the fact that they've got access to allied health services such as dietitians and psychologists, and they've probably got better access to that than we do have in tertiary care. So finding approaches to management, whether that be within the community or whether it be within a severe asthma clinic, I think is the way to go.
One question that often comes up from patients is the relationship between diet and asthma. Peter, you've recently presented some research on the benefits of a high fibre diet on symptoms, haven't you?
So what's happened to our diet in the last 50 years is that we've got less fibre, more sugar, and more fat, more saturated fat. And what's the baddie there is not exactly known, but certainly if you eat soluble fibre, you allow the gut microbiome to produce anti-inflammatory fatty acids, and they get absorbed, and then that appears to have some beneficial effects.
And you point out in the paper that inhaler technique has a big influence on adherence.
Yeah. So inhaler technique is a big problem for anyone with lung disease, really. I think in an asthma population, it's about 30% of people are able to demonstrate proficient technique. So that's really poor. And, if they're not using their inhaler correctly, they're clearly not getting the prescribed dose of medications. So, you can start really early in the piece ensuring that that continues to be proficient on a regular basis at follow-up and review. So having those resources available to patients where they can click on a video and watch how to do it is another resource that we want to develop further. And I think we've had an increase in the number of different devices that have become available to people. And the more devices they use increases their inability to use them correctly. So rationalising their therapy so that they can have a minimal number of different devices is likely to lead to better outcomes too.
The MJA article also suggests that another systems problem is the fact that people would rather get a reliever medication over the counter than go to the trouble of getting a prescription for corticosteroids. Is that a big issue, do you think?
So I think people generally like to simplify life as much as possible. We're all a little non-adherent in things that we should do, such as what we should eat and how often we should exercise. So if we normalise that non-adherence, we're more likely to be able to establish open communication with patients, and they're more likely to report their actual dose taking rather than what they want you to know. So we would generally tell people it's normal for people to forget to take their medication sometimes. Tell me how many times you've missed your doses in the last week, for example. And I think as a follow-up, then asking, well, you know, life gets really busy, so I can understand that you might miss some doses, but what are the reasons that you're not taking it? They might not be taking their medication because they're not necessarily aware of how frequently they should take it, so they've misunderstood messages. I guess the other thing that's really important in terms of asthma self-management is ensuring people have written action plans, and that's again a personalised treatment plan. And these written action plans, when combined with regular review and self-management, lead to significant reductions in exacerbations.
Finally, I don't know if we should talk about the asthma storm in Melbourne last November. That wasn't an example of severe asthma, of course, but a rare allergenic event.
It's a great story, buddy.
It's intense, yeah. Isn't it? Was that such a freakish event that we don't need to worry about it in future?
No, it's not. So it happens across in eastern Australia. Asthma can cause sudden epidemics. Nothing has been as big as Melbourne, however. It's an argument in favour of over-the-counter Ventolin. Could happen with a massive air pollution accident, a massive dust accident. You know, you could have a bushfire thing. We're full of potential risks. What it's highlighted is the need for epidemic management and monitoring around asthma.
Many thanks to Peter Gibson and Vanessa McDonald for joining us on this episode of Pomegranate Health. You can read their review on severe asthma in the June issue of the Internal Medicine Journal, while the May issue has an article on preparedness for another asthma storm event. To find other references on asthma management, including inhaler videos for patients, visit the website at racp.edu.au/pomcast. At the website, we've uploaded additional parts of this interview, talking about preventative use of biologics, management of pregnant women on controller therapy, and differential treatment of COPD. You'll also find a list of some other medical podcasts recommended by our listeners. I Am Reasoning Out of Auckland is an in-depth examination of diagnostic error and bias. And Pediacast CME presents the latest in continuing medical education for pediatric care in the US. Please continue the conversation for any episode of Pomegranate Health via the comments section or email us through pomcast@racp.edu.au. I'm Mick Cavazzini. I hope you've enjoyed the show.